Thanks for coming along tonight, and thanks to King and Wood Mellisons for the use of this fine facility this evening. It's great to have John Howard, Australia's 25th Prime Minister and Australia's second longest-serving Prime Minister, here tonight. It's a great honour for the Institute. He's always been a great supporter of the Institute, which we very much appreciate. So I don't really need to introduce him beyond saying what I've said, but I also should say that John Howard's here on the occasion of the publication of his third book. He did, as you know, a book, a political autobiography, then he did a biography of Robert Menzies, and this is his third book, A Sense of Balance, and it's a sub-title is How A Sense of Balance Has Defined Us as a Nation and Will Safeguard Our Future. And there are copies of that book available tonight, and I'm sure Mr. Howard will be only too happy to sign copies. And tonight's topic is Defining Us as a Nation, Guarding Our Future. John Howard, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Gerard. Can I start by saluting the Sydney Institute for continuing as a beacon of a place to perpetuate the battle of ideas. Politics, more than anything, is about a contest of ideas. And in order to have a good contest of ideas, you need to have groups in the community who are encouraging an examination of ideas. Obviously, political parties are an integral part of that process, but by definition, they are profoundly partisan. And the collective that promotes the contest of ideas has to include organisations such as the Sydney Institute, and the work that Gerard and Anne and the other people at the Institute have done over the years to keep that contest going. And could I also, while I'm acknowledging things, pay tribute to my publisher. Authors should always thank publishers. And the publisher is not an unknown force in the world media. It's HarperCollins, which somebody tells me is owned by a very significant media player, indeed the most significant Australian business figure, Rupert Murdoch, in my view, who's made a greater impact on the world business stage than any other person produced. And I particularly acknowledge the presence of Hannah Lynch from HarperCollins, who is my campaign director on this exercise. Selling a book is a bit like running an election campaign. You've got to turn up, you've got to talk to people, you've got to persuade them, you've got to encourage them to buy your book so that you can sign it and say nice things in the inscription. So I've got to tell you that having an enthusiastic campaign director is very important. Now, why did I write this book? I was provoked into writing this book by the appalling condescension of the self-appointed political elites and political commentators who poured scorn on two democratic decisions. Firstly, they poured scorn on the democratic decision of the British people to leave the European Union, a decision, incidentally, that I warmly endorsed. I was always a Brexiteer, not unlike the newly elected Prime Minister of Britain, who was once a Romanian and is now a Brexiteer, but God bless her and good luck to her. The other event that scorn was poured on was the decision of the American people in 2016 to elect Donald Trump as President of the United States. Now, let me say that that was not a decision that particularly excited me. I in fact, was on record as saying before Trump's election that the prospect of him becoming President of the United States made me tremble. Now, as events turned out, I thought he made some very good decisions. I thought his handling of the economy was good. His handling of the pandemic was appalling. And those press conferences he conducted where he just rambled at will were very disconcerting. But what really cost him my support, not that it meant anything, as I didn't have a vote, I'm not an American, and was his appalling unwillingness to accept the decision of the American people. But my point is that when these two events occurred, the self-appointed elites and commentators felt that the mob had got it wrong. And they basically said, how dare these poorly educated, poorly remunerated people in the north of England, in places like Sunderland, and in the midwest of the United States, how dare they vote in the way they did? How dare they not deliver the presidency of the United States to Hillary Clinton, who called them deplorables? And how dare they not stay in the European Union, which was the fount of all goodness and wisdom? And it really provoked me, because I thought it represented an attitude of mind that reeked of condescension. And it also caused me to examine in a little more detail the structure of political parties, not only in Great Britain and the United States, but also, of course, in Australia. So having been provoked into that, I then wrote a book which represents a stream of consciousness on a number of issues. And I chose the title A Sense of Balance, because I think one of the most defining issues, or one of the most defining characteristics, rather, of the Australian achievement. Now, the Australian achievement was a wonderful description that Malcolm Fraser wanted to give to the 200-year celebration of the British settlement in Australia. And I thought it was a good description, because it really encapsulated what we are about. Australia is an achievement. It's a distinctly Australian achievement. It's something of which we should be very proud. The description of Australian achievement is not triumphalist, white or otherwise. It's a plain statement of reality. And as I examined that, it became very apparent to me that this sense of balance, which I examine in some detail, has been with us for a long time. I mean, one of the clever things this country did right from the beginning of European settlement was to take the good bits of our British inheritance and reject the bad bits. We took the rule of law, we took the freedom of the press, to some degree we took our sense of humour, we embraced, and I say this with a little more passion in New South Wales, Queensland than in other parts of Australia, many of our sporting tastes, but we rejected the bad bits. We rejected class distinction. We rejected the notion of an aristocracy, or a bunyip aristocracy, as the famous W.C. Wentworth spoke of many, many, many years ago. So we got it right. Was it W.C. Wentworth?
Yeah.
Yeah, good. Thank you. And I think that was something that went on to permeate the development of Australia. We have a wonderful balance in social provision. I hold the view that Australia has got the sweet spot when it comes to social welfare provision. We're not as harsh as the Americans, and we're not as paternalistic and interventionist as the Europeans. I think aspects of America's social welfare system does drive people into crime and is disruptive. And equally, I think the European system is so paternalistic that it robs many firms of the capacity to hire and fire in appropriate circumstances, and robs them of inefficiency. And when I look at our education system, it's got plenty of faults, and I don't initiate a discussion on mobile phones, we'll be here all night, but it is a system that provides far more choice. And I've never forgotten the absolute astonishment George Bush, when I told him that 34% of Australian school-aged children are educated in the non-government sector. He couldn't believe it. And I think one of the things that we have done very well is to get that balance. And you saw in the pandemic, with all the weaknesses and all the criticisms people made, incidentally, I thought the government, the federal government at the time, and the state governments of both political persuasion handled the pandemic pretty well. And I don't think we've given ourselves as a nation much enough credit. If you got COVID in Australia, you were 34 times less likely to die than if you lived in the United Kingdom, and 45 times less likely to die, if you can measure less likelihood of dying. I'm not sure you can, but it's an interesting statistical comparison. And I think it does drive home thoughts of that. So that's one of the themes of the book. But along the way, I talk about something that is best summarised by the title of a chapter called Bowling Alone. There was an American sociologist called Robert Putnam who wrote this wonderful book that traced the decline in people joining organisations. And he said that years ago in America, people went to bowling alleys as groups. And he said he detected big change, people would gather on their own. And he picked this up because he discovered that the beer and pizza sales at bowling alleys had declined very sharply, which indicated that it was not. And of course, from that, he just developed this theme. And we're aware of that. All organisations struggle now to get members. And it affects their influence. There's one great exception to that, unions. Unions still struggle to get members, but their influence and power has gone up exponentially. But anyway, that's another subject, and I won't get into that too much tonight unless I'm asked about it. But jokes aside, and that's not really a joke at all, it's quite a serious issue, but we are living in a society which is a non-joiner. And his theory was that those who came of age in really what the Americans call the greatest generation, which is the generation that fought in World War II. I've never given that description to that generation in Australia, much as all of I admire them. I think the generation that went before them that had to endure the impact of World War I, which had a far greater proportionate impact on Australia than it did on the United States and the Great Depression. But the point he made very simply was that we are no longer living in an age where people normally join organisations. Now, that's had a huge impact on churches. It's had a huge impact on local sporting groups, parents and citizens, parents and friends. And it's also had a big impact on political parties. And they are smaller. They are less representative of the people who are normally disposed to vote for them. Years ago, people joined the Labor Party because they had a very strong sense of social justice, whether you shared those views or not. You had to respect them. And many people joined the Liberal Party because they thought it best represented their belief in free enterprise, in small business, and individual freedom. And, of course, many of you will know, and some of you will have experienced the upsurge in Liberal Party support after World War II, after Menzies had formed the Liberal Party, when an attempt was made to nationalise the private trading banks, because that was seen as a direct attack on the free enterprise principle. So I've talked about that. I've talked about the influence of factionalism in political parties. And if you have a smaller membership base, factions are more venomous and can have a greater influence because they've got a smaller group to organise. And I think they do represent I wouldn't say an existential threat, but they certainly represent a serious threat to the viability of our major political parties. I've also, as part of the stream of consciousness, talked about our relations with China. And let me say just one thing about relations with China. It is our most difficult foreign policy relationship. And let me say at the outset, I don't have any basic criticism of the manner in which the newly elected Labor government has handled that relationship, because it has largely followed what was the approach of the former government, which in turn followed what had been the attitude of earlier governments, and we've had a fair degree of bipartisanship. But I think the point I make most strongly about our relationship with China is that I do not share the view of many commentators that it is inevitable that China will overtake the United States as the most powerful country in the world. I think China has two huge problems. The first one is demography. China will grow old before she grows rich. She's following the path of Japan, the only with a declining birth rate, but the only big difference, and it's a huge difference, is that Japan started off as a wealthy country compared with China. I think it's a big challenge. And the other thing is that China will see, as more and more people are born into relative affluence, those people will want a greater say in running their own lives. And although autocracy and totalitarianism seems very much to be holding sway in China at the moment, I'm not sure that's going to continue indefinitely. Two other issues I talk about are the possibility of Australia becoming a republic. As some of you might know, I have mildly anti-republican views, say the least. And I accept that when Her Majesty dies, and there will be some reappraisal in this country. I'm not sure that it will lead to a change. I don't know. And I say that in the book. I don't think any of us know, because she's been such an astonishingly effective and durable lady. And when I think that I celebrated my 83rd birthday only a few weeks ago, that I was 12 years of age, and just in my first year of Canterbury Boys High School, when she ascended to the throne. And a lot's changed since then, although we held the ashes then. So you've got to keep a sense of perspective about these things. But an astonishing person. But I think one of the interesting observations to make is that I don't think, for all the turmoil there may be in Australian politics, I don't think, in comparison with alternative systems, democratic systems, that is, that are on offer, Australians at the moment would think there's anything fundamentally wrong with our current structure of government. I think we are seeing, with the travail that the Republican Party is going through, and I make the point very strongly that I hope the Republican Party finds an alternative to Donald Trump. I don't think he's fit to be president again after having tried to bully his vice president into defying the will of the American people. Now, that is an observation that will probably draw criticism on me from some people who might normally be disposed occasionally to agree with things I say, but I feel it very strongly. And finally, I do offer some opinions on why I thought the coalition lost the last election, and no doubt I could be asked questions about that. Gerard, that's just a brief conspectus, and you might now want to cross-examine me.
You want to have one of those? That's for you if you want to. Yeah, especially blessed. Well, thanks for that. Now, it's down there now.
What do you want me to do?
No, you stay here. Copies of John Howard's book is available for sale later. I should be showing it to the camera, but I've left it over there. And he'll be happy to sign it. And also Anne will be advertising them online, and people on our Zoom can get in touch and we'll post them out. So that's all that. Thanks again to King & Wood Mellisons for this facility. And I should also say, publishers HarperCollins, okay? Now, we're just going to lead off with questions, but in your first chapters, The Mob, How Dare They?, and you mentioned that earlier in your speech tonight, and you talk about people looking with disdain, but a lot of the people who look with disdain on what you're talking about here are people who lived in your old seat of Bennelong, some when you lived in the where you, I think you lived in the electorate of North Sydney for a while. It's another one, Geelong, Goldstein in Melbourne, Perth, Brisbane. Hobart would have gone the same way if it had been that case, because I think the coalition's vote is the lowest in Australia in Hobart, and in a city, and Adelaide too. So to some extent, the people who are showing disdain towards the people you believe they should not show disdain towards are people who once voted for you and your colleagues. So what's happened there?
Well, I don't know what connection you're trying to draw, Jared, between...
What has changed is
result of the last election. Well, I think the biggest reason why we lost the last election was we didn't have a program for the future. It's not enough, in my view, in modern politics, to simply rely on past preference. Now, it is right to say that the national security record of the coalition was better than that of the Labor Party, although, in all honesty, one has to say that the Solomon Islands, an exception to that, I thought the Solomon Islands would have, what has happened there, and particularly as the anti-Australian attitudes of the current Prime Minister are well known. I was certainly aware of them when I was Prime Minister, and they're certainly well known to all major policy makers on both sides of politics. I thought the absence of a forward program, particularly an economic plan, was a major reason why we lost. It was an interesting election in a number of respects. It was about, I think, the lowest primary vote of a winning party since World War II. It was 32.75%. The primary vote of the coalition when I won in 1996 was 47%, it was the primary vote. The primary vote of the Labor Party when I lost to Kevin Rudd in 2007 was about 44%. So it was a pretty grudging win. The other thing that I found interesting from a political science point of view was that if you looked across the political spectrum, it was an election result that gave victory to the sort of, you might say, two extremes. That's perhaps an unfair word to use in relation to the National Party on the right, but not in relation to the Greens. They are an extremist party in every way. But they did very well. The National Party did not lose a single seat in the House of Representatives, and the Greens astonishingly won three. It was a very, very good result for the Greens and a very good result for the Nats. A pretty so-so result for the Labor Party and a bad result for the Liberal Party. That always happens when you have a big shift. The Liberal Party, relatively speaking, does worse because they hold, they have a wider spread of seats. Why did the Teals do so well? I think there's a mixture of reasons. I think an overlooked reason is that there was a lot of tactical voting by Labor people in those seats. You look at the seat of Goldstein, which is the Bay Area, Brighton, Sandringham area of Melbourne, the decline in the Labor vote was much higher than the decline in the Liberal vote, something like 17% versus 12%. But I think on top of that, simple fact that a lot of people in those seats, and I live in one of them, I live in the electorate of North Sydney, voted for the Teals because they couldn't bring themselves to vote Labor, and they saw the Teals as an alternative. In the same way that in the past some people have voted would vote for a party in between and rather than bring themselves to vote Liberal. I think that was a factor. And I've said this in the book, I thought the former Prime Minister's attack on Christine Holgate was very ill-judged and would have offended a lot of successful professional women. I think those sort of tangibles have a bigger impact than people imagine. I mean, I happen to know the lady in question, and not well, but I frankly could not understand why that was said, and it seemed to me that she'd not done anything egregiously wrong. Quite the reverse. You sort of reward people who they do good things for your company. On the other hand, let me say, I think the former Prime Minister has been unfairly criticised for his handling of COVID. I thought he handled it well. I thought he brought things together through the National Cabinet. I noticed the National Cabinet still continues, and I thought there was a much higher level of cooperation there. There's some of my thoughts as to why we lost, but...
Got a question here on coming in from Canberra, which is with the emphasis on liberalism, which is from Dennis O'Day. Why? What do you see as the path for the Liberal Party to create a revival of liberalism in Australia?
Well, I noticed we had some ecclesiastical references at the beginning. I am a strong believer in the broad church. I think the best thing that Peter Dutton has said since becoming leader of the Liberal Party is that I'm not a moderate, I'm not a conservative, I'm a liberal. And I'm the leader of the... I was rather the leader of the Liberal Party of Australia. And it's always had, for want of a better expression, small L liberal beliefs and also conservative beliefs. Menzies, who founded the party, was the epitome of that. I mean, his views on economics in the definitions now used were extremely conservative, not liberal. He didn't... He believed in keeping things as they were. I've been reading in recent days the speech he made to Parliament late in 1965, just before he retired, when he announced that the then government was going to reject the recommendations of the Vernon Committee of Inquiry into the Australian economy, which some of you will recall and be aware of. He said that the government was a protectionist government. Now, that was a bipartisan attitude in Australian politics in the 1960s. And if we're to have a serious discussion about these things, we have to be mindful of the terms that we apply to attitudes, and what is sometimes called a liberal attitude is not a liberal attitude at all, it's a conservative one, and vice versa. I mean, Menzies was a traditionalist on a lot of things, obviously on the monarchy, on the federation. He had strong views that we should remain close to what he described as our great and powerful allies. And he had in mind there, of course, the United States and the United Kingdom. But he was also, he showed his great liberal instincts, as I understand the term, in the extraordinary initiative in the 1960s of granting state aid to independent or largely Catholic schools, which for 100 years had been discriminated against. They paid their taxes like everybody else, but they didn't get any help from the government. And that, to me, was liberal, radical, and... but certainly wasn't the conservative position, was to say no. And if you don't like the system, if you don't want to go to a government school, you can pay to go to a private school. So he was a mixture. I was a mixture. I still am, of course. I'm still alive. So present tense. And I was conservative on many things. I opposed Australia becoming a republic. I voted against same-sex marriage, but that issue is now behind us, the public's decided it. And I guess on a lot of foreign policy issues I was seen as having a conservative position, but I thought the whole attitude I took on industrial relations was very liberal, even radical. I mean, the idea that you should be able, subject to guaranteed minimum conditions, make a deal with your employer without the compulsory intervention of a trade union doesn't strike me as anything but a thoroughly common sense, a small liberal attitude. So I can go on with those examples, but the first thing that as a Liberal Party, properly examines the future. First thing we've got to understand is if we think we solve it by resolving it in favour of one or other view of the future of the party, we do have a problem. And you have to accept that it is a broad church, and maybe the pews are getting a bit crowded on one side occasionally, but the reality is that we have always done well when we've seen ourselves as a combination of both, and we've always done well when you have people in leadership and other key positions who are the same. So the liberalism of which your questioner spoke is the liberalism as espoused by Peter Dutton, the liberalism that I endeavoured to give, and the liberalism that I'm sure that Menzies always wanted the party to hang on to.
At the back.
Mr. Howard, the last questioner stole a little bit of my thunder on the fact that you've always been an advocate of the Liberal Party being a broad church. But the fact is that the Liberal Party has lost in the last election many of the seats that have been historically viewed as the crown jewels of the Liberal Party. North Sydney, Wentworth, Goldstein, Higgins, they've all gone. And the people who occupied those seats would have been seen as the strength of the moderate wing of the Liberal Party, I would say. How, in your view, is the Liberal Party going to win those seats back if it is not able to persuade the general public in Australia that it is basically a centrist political party advocating a plan for the future that is in keeping with that view?
Well, sir, I don't share your analysis of the political identity, all of the people who lost, as you were asking that question. Thought of two people who lost, namely Josh Frydenberg in Kooyong and Celia Hammond, who lost the seat of Curtin in Western Australia. I wouldn't say they necessarily epitomised the smaller Liberal. I mean, I thought Josh Frydenberg was the standout performer in the former government. And Celia Hammond, I didn't know her well, but I think this categorisation, this compulsion to categorisation that the Liberal Party is now embracing is absurd. And they stop doing it. I'm not directing that remark at you, sir, but I'm directing it at the generality. I don't think when people voted in North Sydney or in Wentworth, they thought, well, I'm going to vote against this person because he is a smaller Liberal or he's a Conservative. I think they just voted against him in those two cases because they were cranky with the Liberal Party. And I don't think the personal views of the individuals who lost really came into it. So I think you win those seats back when you have removed some of the reasons for that anger and discontent. And I think we'll make a terrible mistake if we say, well, we've got to choose people, we've got to get policies and everything that are based on an assumption that there was an anti-conservative or anti-small liberal component in the decision taken in those seats. I just don't think that would make any sense. I think it's some of the people who are lost were very good. I'm not singling out those two, but they're two that certainly come to mind and in different parts of the country. And I hope that, and I believe that Josh Frydenberg will come back. And I hope he does. Cedar could, I don't know. But she had only been in Parliament for 3 years, but she had a very distinguished academic career. And the Liberal Party doesn't always attract academics. They often attract the criticism of academics. So I think she was a very high-quality member. So I think my plea to people who care about the future of the Liberal Party is try and avoid the nomenclature of division. And the nomenclature of division is to search, you know, like a you've got a, an ideological Geiger counter, and you're searching for some manifestation of a person's conservatism or small L liberalism or moderate. Or
question down there.
Yeah, thanks.
John,
you as you well know, the Liberal Party is very much based on its state strengths. The states determine the strength of the party, and it seems to me that right now the problem for the Liberal Party is at the state level. Western Australia, very poor. Victoria, not so good. New South Wales, we don't know yet. Maybe Queensland's holding up. What do you do when it's a matter of the problem in the states? Because you really have to fix that first, I would have thought.
And I don't think the with respect, I don't accept that analysis. That there have been numerous examples of where the coalition did very well federally in a state where it did very bad state at a state level. I mean, I memorably recall Queensland, which was in the time that I was Prime Minister, Queensland was the standout performer for the coalition. Apart from 2007, when it wandered off the reservation a little bit. But other than that, I mean, we did extraordinarily well in Queensland. Yet for most of that time, the Liberal Party in the country, the National Party, is performing badly at a state level in Queensland. So, and I think back to the Fraser days. New South Wales, relatively speaking, was a very good state for Malcolm Fraser. And in 1980, we lost seats hand over fist in Victoria, but we held on to our seats in, I mean, we even hang on to Michael Bohm's seat in 1980, but we lost seats in Victoria. And yet it was also the state that delivered two landslides, and ran one in 1978 with a huge swing, and he got an equally big swing, well, not the same thing, but he held on to most of it in 1980. So I don't think it follow. I mean, I actually think our federal structure, and I'm not much of a states' rights, as most people know, I'm a nationalist, but I do think the federal structure of the Liberal Party over the years has helped us. And I just remind you of one point I made in the book I wrote about the Menzies era, that if the Labor Party in the 1950s had had the federated structure that the Liberal Party had, the great Labor split would never have occurred, because the majority of the Victorian Labor Party would have resisted. It was grouper-based, and it would have resisted the dismantling of the existing state Labor structure, and the federal party would never have been able to. Our federal executive does not have the power, and I don't think it should have the power to dismantle a state executive. It can use persuasion and everything, but I think probably it's a good balance. Having said all of that, obviously the Liberal Party's next big task is to hold state government in New South Wales. That's very, very important, and it won't be easy, but it's certainly not impossible. I think Dominic Perrottet has the great strength and virtue of wanting to do things. He's got policy ideas, and I admire him for that. But we have to work very hard, because if we were to lose in New South Wales, we'd be out of office in every mainland state. But things come back quickly. I remember when Tony Abbott won in 2013, people were talking about the end of the Labor Party, because we were back in government after only 6 years in opposition. And people said, heavens above, you know, the Labor Party's hopeless. It won with a big majority in 2007, and 6 years later it's out of government. So it does come back, but we nonetheless have a big fight in New South Wales.
Mr. Howard, notwithstanding your sentiments on the broad church, which are admirable, given the way politics seems to be operating these days, the changing ways, and given the increasing difficulty and complexity of running a political party, as far as the Liberals are concerned, is the broad church now too broad?
No, I don't think so. Perhaps I can best respond by saying, what is the alternative? The alternative is years of deeper division and argument. Because when you have people who say the right way is this way, and you have another group saying the right way is that way, and they are each struggling for acceptance, you inevitably get conflict. And that will further undermine and enfeeble us. And that's why I think you have to accept and you have to observe protocols for reaching decisions. One of the other points I make in my book very strongly is that I think the pre-selection protocols of the Liberal Party should be fully respected. I thought it was an error of the former government to protect sitting members. It was a huge error. And it affected, I don't want to get too specific, but it sort of protected people of, a range of views. And I stood for two federal pre-selections. I stood for the seat of Barara in 1971, after Tom Hughes decided to quit politics. And I was one of the 32 unsuccessful candidates. And then I stood for the seat of Bennelong in 1973, and I was the successful candidate out of 25. And they were both, Barau was even safer than Bennelong. Bennelong then was pretty good. It was regarded then as the weakest of the safe seats. It's now, of course, it went back to the Labor Party at the last election. I don't think they had anything to do with many of the other issues. I think we did suffer with in electorates that had a high Chinese enrolment. I think there was a very effective campaign waged by the Labor Party on those issues. I don't direct any critical remarks of Chinese Australians. It's just that there were issues, and I think it hurt us badly. But I do think that we have to understand that the alternative to the broad church is constant civil war. We can't afford, no political party can do that. And I think that everybody who has the interests of the Liberal Party, and that's not everybody, I don't suggest for a moment everybody in this room, not by any means, but you have to look at history, and stability is a very important thing.
Question here?
Gentlemen.
No, we're here. When you got the microphone, you got the
call. I want to first express my appreciation for you recognizing the daytime inhabitants of this building. Okay. Question is, you talked about people not joining. That's probably because of the internet now and social groups. There's a lot of joining of groups. It's just that they're small. And they're outside formal things. So the question I have is, given the structure of social media, do you think it's possible for major parties like Labour and Liberals to really maintain a sizable presence?
I think that's your observation makes an enormous amount of sense. I think that is part of the issue. And that applies to all sorts of organisations. And fortunately for me, there was no Twitter when I was Prime Minister. It didn't really start until after I left. And social media was virtually non-existent then. And the most exciting communication thing was YouTube. That's sort of regarded as very behind the game these days. So I think it is difficult. But there were other reasons why people stopped joining a long time ago, and many of them had to do with the social upheaval of the 1960s, where a lot of people were exhorted to reject everything that had gone before, And it was precisely because Mum and Dad belonged to this or that organisation that I wasn't going to join it. And I think that was, I do think also that television, it's a long time ago now, came to Australia in the middle 1950s, had a big impact, older people's social behaviour. And I also think that the old pattern of when there were far fewer women in the workforce of Dad coming home from work and eating dinner that had been prepared by my mum and then going off to the meeting. That's changed because of the participation, much larger participation of women in the workforce. They're all visible factors, but your point about there being a lot of exchange at a smaller level through the internet is absolutely right. Question here.
Mr. Howard, thank you for the presentation. My question is on economics. Your government paid down $96 billion of debt. We're now approaching $1 trillion of debt at a federal level. State balance sheets are in a terrible state. And while I agree entirely that, you know, we have the balance right on how we treat our welfare systems, we have programs like the NDIS that are clearly unsustainable in their current form. Have we forgotten about debt and deficit?
Well, I think to some extent, we have at a leadership level in federal politics. And can I make the point ever so strongly that the debt we have now is a bipartisan debt. And it annoys the hell out of me every time I hear Dr. Chalmers saying we've inherited $1 trillion of Liberal debt. Well, he wanted us to inherit $1 trillion plus of debt. He wanted us to spend more. I mean, I supported the measures that were taken by Josh Frydenberg. He did ask my view on it. I'm sure he asked the view of a number of people. But I thought it was right because it was the first recession I was aware of that had been deliberately created by the government. And it was created in order to protect lives and health. And having created the recession or the near recession, it was the obligation of the government to inject money into the economy to pull it around. And I hope that the first budget of the Albanese government has a sensible attack on the deficit. I'll be very interested, as no doubt you and others who care about our public finances, exactly what is going to happen. But it is not a Liberal debt. It was a bipartisan debt. And the last people who can lecture us, we Liberals, including myself, on debt and deficit are members of the Federal Labor Party who are past masters at running it up.
There's a question here.
Thank you, Mr. Howard. You said to start off with that politics is the contest of ideas, and I want to ask you that in the context of the name of your book, A Sense of Balance. Mm. Are you saying that you need to allow some ideas to prevail in some instances and then in another? Or is another way of saying a sense of balance is that you need to compromise? And when I ask that question, I'm thinking of what happened with the GST, where to get the GST through, and as you highlighted at the time, we needed to shift our taxation system, and yet to get that approved, you had to do the deal with the Democrats to exclude food, and we are now in the situation that we have arguably a need for increasing or expanding the GST to overcome what has been referred to as our debt. So my question is your naming of your book Sense of Balance really another way of saying that you need to compromise?
No, I think it's more a general observation that having a balanced approach can mean you come down heavily on one or other side of the argument. For many years, I mean, I talked about education, the argument was whether the state should give any support to non-government schools. Now, that was very unbalanced. And we achieved a sense of balance there when we recognised that a lot of people, although they were prepared to make some financial sacrifice to educate their children outside the government sector, it was an impossible burden unless they were fairly well off. So I think it's a balance in that sense, and that we have a balanced approach. In America, there's still an argument about some fundamentals in the health area that we sort of stopped talking about and arguing about years ago. I mean, there are still many Americans who argue trenchantly against state involvement and state support for people. They think it should all be private. Well, that's unrealistic. I don't think that's compromise. I think it's just sensible. The second part of the, I think I've forgotten the second.
Which was in relation to the GST.
Oh, the GST. Well, that was just common sense. We had put up a plan. I mean, the public voted for the GST on food. And in the process of winning that election, we had shed a huge number of seats. What was the alternative? Do a deal with the Democrats or commit political suicide and have another election? And I don't think that made any sense at all. And that is one of the reasons why, in another chapter in the book, I argue very strongly that we should revisit the possibility of having a referendum to alter the Constitution so that you don't have to have a double dissolution in order to have a joint sitting. It's sufficient if a bill is rejected twice in 3 months by the Senate, then to have a joint sitting of the existing parliament. And I also reconstruct what that would have meant in the last 20 or 30 years. And it wouldn't have meant, for example, that Albanese could have could put something up twice without going back. It wouldn't have meant that Scott Morrison could have done so. It would have meant that Kevin Rudd could have got something through. And ironically enough, if that provision had obtained with his climate change legislation, when the Greens voted with the coalition to oppose it, the greatest own goal in recent Australian political history, that wouldn't have been necessary. So I think with the GST, I had no alternative. I think it's pity, and what makes it a pity is that what the public voted for was a GST on food. Now, I don't think they consciously put a tick beside GST on food, but they supported tax reform. They didn't like the GST because it was a new tax and it was easy to scare people, but there was a feeling that our tax system had become antiquated. We needed something new, and we put up a big comprehensive plan. We put it up in detail, and in more detail than we've ever seen in an election campaign. And it was quite a hard campaign because you were always hostage to, not just myself, but Peter Costello, and particularly it was just very difficult.
Mm. Okay, we've got time for two questions. There's one here, and Michael Bowen will end up. Just got to be brief.
How are you, George?
I'm very well, thank you, John. When you and I, look, Peter Dutton says I'm a liberal. When you and I were in the Young Liberals together in the 1960s, we actually knew what that meant. Today, I wonder how many people, and I would bet that 80% of the Australian population doesn't understand what that means today. And can you explain it? And can you find somebody that can articulate that to the general population to educate them what we actually stand for?
I think, George, you and I and the Young Liberals in the early 1960s, yeah, late 50s, early 60s, and we were still living in the wake of the Great Labor Split. And everything was defined then, overwhelmingly, in terms of foreign policy. One of the big changes that's occurred is that we have far more focus now on domestic policy. Menzies won in 1951, largely running an anti-communist thing. In 1954, he almost lost, but Bert Everett was the leader of the Labor Party. 1955 was just after the split. 1958, he was still living in the wake of the split. 1961, he almost lost because there was to Arthur Calwell, because there was a big recession. Now, you asked me to define what liberalism, well, might, it is still the party above all of individualism. It's a party of private enterprise. It's a party of individual freedom. It's a party that defends those institutions we've had for a long time that work. I mean, I believe in changing something that doesn't work. That's why I've argued very strongly for industrial relations reform, because I don't think it works. I see Bill Kelly says the present system's broken. Well, I think it's broken, but I don't want to fix it the way he wants to fix it. And I think the Liberal Party has made a big mistake in recent years in running away, really, from industrial relations reform. I think it went to water on that issue mistakenly, and I think it has to return to it, because it's one of the things that's fundamental to our free enterprise system.
OK, last question. Michael.
On that very issue, when you were Minister for Business and Consumer Affairs in 1976, you introduced the revolutionary Section 45D of the Trade Practices Act. To what extent is your view, as evidenced by that action, of industrial relations now in great danger of being totally destroyed, and what are the consequences for the Australian economy? And finally, does this provide Dutton with a fantastic election campaign opportunity?
Just before we start, 45D secondary boycotts.
Yeah, I know.
No, you know, but
a lot of other people. I wrote the bill, yeah. Look, Section 45D was an amendment to the Trade Practices Act, which removed the absurd anomaly where if you, as a business, imposed a boycott on a rival, you could be prosecuted, but if you were a union, you couldn't. And I just said, and on this issue, I had very strong support from Malcolm Fraser, who was then the Prime Minister. And in fact, one of the very first meetings I had with Bob Hawke was on this very issue, and he was wearing his union hat and he talked about blood in the streets and everything. It was a colourful exchange. But and I'm very proud that we went ahead with that. It was incidentally neutered by a subsequent Labor government, by the Hawke government, because they gave it to the then Arbitration Commission, and that meant that it didn't work, it wouldn't be allowed to work. And it was brought back by Peter Reith when he was Industrial Relations Minister in my government. Now, I think it's a bit too early to tell how this IR issue develops. It obviously is going to be a big battleground, but I'm not sure the government at the moment is going to try and reverse 45D, although they'd be under pressure from the unions to do so, and it's very obvious from the behaviour of the transport unions in New South Wales that the unions now think the boys are back in charge and will make merry hell. And I thought that email from Mr. Clausens, that's his name, isn't it? Clausen, yeah. But he, I thought that was an extraordinary, but very revealing. And he's saying we're going to make their life misery out of the next election. Well, that's even-handed industrial. This is the new harmony, the new karma that Mr. Albanese has promised us. I think this could be a very good issue, but you have to fight it on the merits. It's not just enough to say, well, you know, we're going to shout industrial relations. You've got to actually carve out an argument and win it on the quality of the argument. And union power, to some people, is protection of their living standards. To other people, it's particularly in small business, it's a menace. And just remember that we're living in an era where 14% of people belong to a union, whereas in the mid-1970s it was about 48%. And yet the power of the union, and I'll finish on this note, the last Chifley Labor cabinet was a more diverse group of men, they were all men then, than the new Albanese cabinet. You had a couple of farmers, you had soldiers, hardly surprising, in 1949, you had a publican, you had a tobacconist. Now, that's practically a criminal offence now, a tobacconist. And you had one lawyer, Dr. Everett, who'd been a High Court judge and a very eminent lawyer. So now the cabinet is overwhelmingly composed of people who are trade union officials or former party functionaries. Now, some of them are no doubt very good and some of them are not so good. I think the only one who had a long time in private enterprise would have been Mark Dreyfus, the Attorney General, who's the Queen's Counsel and obviously a very talented lawyer.
Many thanks. So thanks to John Howard for a terrific presentation tonight of contemporary Australian politics, historical Australian politics and reflections overseas. We're very grateful. I was thinking you might make a good panellist on some rather dull ABC programmes if you're looking for a gig, or if you get an invitation. That's another point. But I digress. So, as we know, we've got copies of John Howard, A Sense of Balance, published by HarperCollins tonight. It's a great read, and a lot of the matters in the book Mr. Howard's addressed tonight, and there are other matters that he hasn't addressed, which are in the book. And it's a very good read, and it's easy to read. It's very well written. So John Howard was happy to sign copies tonight, and also for our friends on Zoom and later on the web, just write into the Sydney Institute. We can provide autographed copies. But for tonight, I won't go on. Just say well done and congratulations.
Thank you.